You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 12th of May 2022 on Monocle 24. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Hello, this is The Globalist, broadcasting to you live from Midori House in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. Coming up on today's programme...
The Prime Minister and I have agreed to face challenges in peace, crisis and conflict together. And if either country should suffer a disaster or an attack, the United Kingdom and Sweden will assist each other in a variety of ways.
Manipulation? Sweden and Finland have signed military pacts with the UK. But is Boris Johnson's hawkish behaviour merely a distraction from his various domestic crises? Then vaccination. As COVID recedes from the consciousness of many Western nations, a global summit convenes at the White House today to encourage support for jabs in the developing world. Plus, polarisation and annihilation. We'll stay with Washington to look at the implications of the Senate vote on abortions, and we'll hear reactions to the death of the Al Jazeera Palestinian-American correspondent who's been killed whilst covering a raid by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank. And finally, adoration.
Music is very big in Sweden. The music industry is very, we're very like, yeah, out there in many ways, and we love this competition.
And we love Eurovision. We'll hear from the Swedish entry, Cornelia Jacobs, ahead of tonight's second semi-final. That's all ahead here on The Globalist, live from London. First, a look at what else is happening in the news. The European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen has called Russia's invasion of Ukraine the most direct threat to world order. Officials in North Korea have ordered a strict national lockdown after confirming the country's first official COVID cases. And one of the Catholic Church's most senior figures, Cardinal Joseph Zen, has been arrested in Hong Kong for breaking China's national security law. Do stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the day for more on those stories. Now, as both Finland and Sweden weigh up joining NATO, Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson has visited both countries, pledging to bolster military ties in the face of Russian aggression. I'm joined now by Petri Bertsov, Monocle's correspondent in Helsinki, and by Charlie Duxbury, Politico's correspondent in Stockholm. Welcome to you both. Let's start in Stockholm with you, Charlie. What's the nature of the military agreement between Sweden and the UK?
Good morning, Georgina. Well, yeah, I think the they were a bit light on kind of specific details of what the UK might do if Sweden were to suffer an attack or a disaster, as they phrased it, or vice versa. But, I mean, I think Johnson wanted to create the impression that, that all options would be on the table and it would depend on what Sweden asked for. And I guess the same would go for his commitment to Finland. Obviously, this comes... in a context of the ongoing debate in Sweden and Finland about potentially joining NATO and a potential few months ahead, if they were to decide to join, to apply to join NATO, where a kind of unclear security situation would be in place before the kind of mutual defence clause of the NATO membership would kick in.
Mm. And Petri, do we have any detail on what was agreed with Finland?
Well, the actual declaration is very similar to that the UK made with Sweden. But then in the press conference last night, which Boris Johnson held with the Finnish president, Sauli Niinistö, local journalist actually asked Johnson, what does this mean in practice? And he replied by saying, well, this means military aid. If Finland is attacked, UK will assist it militarily. So he made it very, very clear because it's a very sensitive issue in Finland, especially this waiting period that Charles mentioned before Finland is officially a member of NATO. You know, it can take up to several months, and Russia has already threatened Finland and Sweden in various ways. So it's a very sensitive issue in Finland, and the local journalist wanted to get the more sort of in detail information from Johnson.
But does military aid mean, you know, supplying military hardware, or does it mean boots on the ground?
He was also asked that, and he said that it's up to the that country which asks for that aid to decide what kind of aid they want. But he said that nothing is off the table. So, you know, it could also mean boots on the ground if that is needed.
Mm. Charlie, the Swedish leader, Magdalena Andersson, has said that Sweden is safer with this pact in place. Is that how the Swedish people feel?
Yeah, I think so. That seemed to be the response to yesterday's news conference with the two leaders. Everybody's kind of, concerned about what a potential application to NATO would mean for Sweden. Obviously, we're not as close to Russia as Finland is here, but there are concerns among the population here about how safe they would be during any transition period to NATO. So I think, Johnson did enough to kind of make people feel slightly safer.
Mm. I mean, Petri, talking about that period between applying to join and actually then being covered by NATO protection, we know, of course, that Finland and Russia share a huge border. Are Finns in favour of joining NATO, given the threat from Russia? Russia's actually said they are watching very closely anything that can affect NATO configuration near our border.
Yes, that's a very good question. Finns are, a large majority of Finns, I think it's 76 or 78%, are in favor of joining NATO. And this is a dramatic turnaround. I mean, for decades, that number has been sort of between 10 and 25, sort of up maximum 30% of Finns have traditionally favored joining NATO. So a majority has been against it. But ever since Russia's war in Ukraine, we've just seen this very dramatic turnaround. And, you know, there's not even a debate about it. Even the further left, the far left parties have been the most vocal against NATO. Even they are now for NATO. So it's such a wide social and political consensus.
Mm, but it hasn't actually been announced properly that this is going to happen. When will we know the definite position regarding a bid for NATO membership?
Well, actually, in about 50 minutes' time. So both the Finnish president, Sauli Niinistö, and Prime Minister Sanna Marin will unveil their view on NATO and Finland's membership at 10 a.m. Helsinki time. So, in 53 minutes. After that, it will go to the Finnish parliament. We already know that every single party in parliament is for Finland joining. Everything points to that the actual application will be lodged by the end of the week.
Mm. Charlie, watching all this from Sweden, I wonder if there's any sense of Boris Johnson's flurry of international activity and hawkish behaviour being used to distract from his domestic troubles. Are the Swedish people cynical about this in any way?
I mean, that issue was raised at the news conference yesterday, and Johnson was keen to obviously bat away questions about his domestic situation as kind of secondary to the security picture in Europe. I think here people are aware of what's going on in UK news, and they're aware that the kind of, Johnson is facing pressure at home. But, at least for the short term, the focus is on the war in Ukraine, what it means for the Swedish security picture, and kind of the focus is there. The next few days obviously going to be key for this NATO debate. So I think people here were kind of keen to put the British domestic politics or English domestic politics to one side.
Mm. Petri, I wonder how significant British military support for Finland is. Does Finland need Britain?
That's a very, very big question. I mean, maybe we can start with a little bit of a background. So Finland has, for all of its history, essentially being outside of military alliances, and it still is before it joins NATO. So that has meant that Finland has a very large land army. I believe one of the largest artilleries in Europe. So it has always had to rely on defending itself. And not, foreign aid. So that's also how the country's defense has also always been built up, and also bearing in mind the two wars against the Soviet Union and living next to them, sharing this 1,300-kilometer land border with them. So, Finland is capable of defending itself But, you know, in view of a possible larger conflict between the democratic quest and Russia, there is a belief that Finland needs to be part of a larger alliance.
Mm. Charlie Johnson said that this is not a short-term stopgap, but a long-term commitment to bolster military ties and fortify Europe's defences for generations to come. And I wonder how this plays into the whole post-Brexit landscape. Is this Britain positioning itself to take a military lead, having left Europe?
Yeah, there's certainly been reaction here in local media, and editorial writers here have been keen to try and see this as a way for the UK to kind of re-engage, certainly with Nordic countries, which, I mean, here people would be keen to see, because when the UK left the EU, it felt like for countries like Sweden and Denmark and Finland that they were losing a kind of an ally in various key questions for them within Europe. So this kind of re-engagement on the security side would be seen as is being seen as a positive step in terms of that re-engagement. And I guess people here would be keen to kind of try and build on that.
Charlie, thank you very much indeed. That was Charlie Duxbury and also Petri Bertsov. Thanks both for joining us here on The Globalist.
The Foreign Desk is Monocle 24's weekly global affairs programme. We tackle the world's biggest news stories, as well as those left untold.
If actually you speak to the ordinary people, their aspirations is for a unified country, whether you talk to business people, to school teachers, to market traders, and so on and so forth, across the board, is they want to see their country recreated as it was, only this time as a democratic, accountable system.
Our expert guests offer in-depth analysis and first-hand experience.
In one of the Ebola treatment centres I went to had been burned down by a community that were very resentful and frightened of Ebola, and they still have a bunker in the middle. They've dug a big, deep bunker where they can hide if people come and shoot at them.
The Foreign Desk with me, Andrew Muller, is available every Saturday from midday London time, right here on Monocle 24.
It's 12 minutes past 7 here in London, 12 minutes past 2 a.m. in Washington, D.C., which is where we're off to next. World leaders will gather today for a virtual global COVID summit at the White House. President Joe Biden is expected to galvanize leaders of wealthy countries to ramp up their commitments to help vaccinate the developing world. But the Biden administration finds itself in an awkward position as it struggles to secure funding to fight the virus at home as well as abroad. Well, let's get the latest now with Monocle's health and science correspondent, Dr. Chris Smith. Chris, thanks for joining us. This summit's been co-hosted by the US, Germany, Belize, Indonesia and Senegal. What's on the agenda?
The agenda really is all about the future. And this is the second of these summits. And this time they set their stall out saying, look, in order to gain control at a time, or maintain control at a time when actually the focus is shifting away from COVID, because cases are going down for a range of reasons, not least that testing is also going down. And this may be breeding an air of complacency, and people think that the problem has gone away, the job is done. And actually that's when the most dangerous point can be, because if you take your eye off the ball, a fire can flare back up again. Mm. And so really what this is all about is securing funding from some of the world's biggest economies to make sure that we can deal with some of the problems that still exist. And they highlight the fact that in poorer countries, the rates of vaccination are still extremely low, about 15%. The target is 70% of vulnerable groups in those countries to try to get those people vaccinated, because people accept we can't stop COVID, although despite the efforts of the Chinese government to relentlessly pursue a zero COVID strategy, most economies recognise this is just not possible. So instead, the focus is shifting onto a living with COVID approach, which means you use vaccines to protect the most vulnerable. And that's really, I think, at the crux of what they're going to be discussing today, getting the funding to get the vaccines into those poorer countries so that the most vulnerable there can be protected, and then everyone can more satisfactorily and realistically live with COVID.
But is part of the problem not supply, but demand?
Well, the problem is that they haven't got the cash to pay for it, and no one wants to be the only person who puts their hand in their pocket. So that's why it's all about leveraging the biggest economies in the world. They're going to the G7, the seven biggest economies, and they're saying, we need you to give what they're dubbing your fair share. And the idea is that you work out roughly what constitutes a fair share, a fair contribution from those countries, and you use this to bankroll the next strategic initiatives of the project. And those are chiefly vaccination, but there will be other things there as well. Testing remains important. The wider we cast the testing net, especially across poorer countries, because poorer countries are going to have uncontrolled disease activity if we're not careful, but that also means they could have the opportunity to surface variants, for example. So having testing and data flowing in from those countries means we have a surveillance network in place, which at the moment we have a very poor surveillance network in many of those countries. The current rates of testing, the target set by the WHO is about 100 tests per 100,000 people. In other words, about 0.1% of the tests that should be done there. It's actually running at about 0.0005% in most of those countries. And this means we've basically got a radar screen with lots of black spots on it that we just can't see inside those blacked out areas. And that's not really going to inform what the virus is doing across the world. I mean, we need a brighter and higher resolution radar screen to keep tabs on this thing.
I wonder which countries got it right. I mean, for instance, talking about testing, South Korea avoided full lockdown with a test and trace system.
Well, initially they did. They'd not indefinitely. They did have to then start putting in place quite a lot of restrictions later. But yes, you're right. They did go straight off the blocks with very fierce and ferocious testing mechanisms, which meant they got the upper hand quite quickly.
And who else did it well?
Well, traditionally, many of these East Asian countries did a good job at the outset because they had patterns of government, they had experience with SARS, they had mechanisms in place where they could quite quickly just get control of what people were doing and get people to comply. So those countries were sort of saluted as being very agile with their testing. Australia also ramped up its testing very, very fast and did it at huge capacity. Testing's only part of the issue, though, because that there are bigger issues here, which are sharing of data. And I think that's going to be one of the other agenda items, really. It's going to be really pushing for sharing the information, sharing learning, and also sharing vaccines, because one of the things that's emerging as we delve more and more into where COVID came from, etc., is that there were a lot of delays in how especially China shared its information or withheld information. And I think people are still a bit bruised about that. And it's interesting that I don't see much mention of China in what's proposed for what they're going to be discussing. And I think this country is very much at the linchpin because they're still pursuing this zero COVID strategy with 25 million people plus in sort of quarantines and lockdowns and so on. They haven't got very high vaccination rates across their elderly, so they're going to be seeing a lot of cases in China. This has knock-on effects for the world economy, and that's one of the other points they make, is that there's also an economic downturn going on, and that always comes home to roost in poorer countries, which will rob them of health investment. And there's the existing problems. COVID's knocked a big hole in the health infrastructure of many countries, including the richer ones, and so those holes still exist. So a range of things which really do need addressing.
And I wonder, finally, about countries like Senegal, for instance, and the lessons that it learned from Ebola. Did the West listen to what experts in poorer countries, which were far more used to dealing with pandemics, were saying and doing?
I don't know, actually, how receptive many governments were to those sorts of experiences. It's certainly true that people ignored problems like Ebola until it became a problem for bigger economies. When we saw the world's first Ebola case outside the African continent, suddenly the world sat up and took notice. And after 45 years, having never had a vaccine, we suddenly had three. It's like buses, three coming along all at once. So I think really what it takes is that something to become real and a threat for big economies, and then they suddenly set up, take notice and invest. Certainly it's true that we understand and appreciate that we learn and we ignore other people's experience at our own cost, but we can learn from everyone's experience. And this is not a problem which is confined to one geography or one society or one sector of society. With infectious diseases, they may start in third world countries, poorer areas, but they spread. They don't need passports to cross international borders. And this is a global problem. It needs a global solution. And that means everyone around the table.
And Chris, this is not over, is it?
No, but the good thing is that one remains optimistic. It's like Patrick Vallance and Chris Whitty said when flanking Boris Johnson at the Downing Street press briefing, where they set out their stall for how we're going to live with COVID. We go out while the sun is shining, but take your umbrella with you. In other words, keep a weather eye out for what the future may hold, because this virus isn't done with us yet. But at the moment, levels are coming down in countries like the UK, coming down everywhere. Testing's dropping, which is usually an indicator that things are improving. But what we mustn't do is take our eye off the autumn ball, because sure as eggs is eggs, these things tend to come resurging in autumn as the weather closes in again in the Northern Hemisphere. So what we're going to be looking out for is what the vaccine strategy for the West will be in the autumn, and no one's really said what they think the long term will be yet, and that's what I'm watching out for.
Dr. Chris Smith, thank you very much indeed. Still to come on the programme, we'll review the day's papers from Zurich, we'll get the latest business headlines, and then we'll hear from Sweden's Eurovision entry, Cornelia Jacobs.
Music is very big in Sweden. The music industry is very, we're very like out there in many ways, and we love this competition.
This is The Globalist. Stay tuned.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Yesterday, the US Senate voted on a bill that would have enshrined into law a woman's right to access abortion nationwide. It failed, opposed by all Republicans and one Democrat, Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia. The body of 100 people, 76% of whom are male, made the decision about the private lives of nearly 168 million women in America. The vote came about as a result of an unprecedented leak of an initial draft majority opinion from the Supreme Court, published by Politico last week, showing the court is set to overturn the Roe versus Wade decision that said the US Constitution protects a woman's right to choose to have an abortion. Well, I'm joined now by Clodagh Harrington, who's Associate Professor of American Politics at De Montfort University. Clodagh, welcome back to the show. Why did this bill fail?
Oh, good morning. Yes, well, this bill failed, I guess, maybe for two reasons. One is that it was a bit of a foregone conclusion in the Senate with regard to how Republicans would vote, because it has become such a, or has always really been, but is especially now an extremely partisan issue. And then just that one vote that sort of stood out, I suppose, was the Democrat Joe Manchin, who's conservative and has his own agendas, and just ensured that this was never going to get any further. Now, I would say that there was always a sense that it was going to fail. So there was that. But Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer did come out and say that, you know, what it would do, if nothing else, is act as a way to put every senator on the record on this issue. And obviously, coming up to the midterms later in the year, that's an important matter.
So how are progressive states dealing with this threat to women's autonomy over their own bodies?
Well, it's interesting to see how the speed and direction of reactions. And basically, if you're in a progressive state, you're okay in this regard in terms of actually accessing an abortion. If you are in a conservative state, the opposite will all but be true, depending on the state that you're in. But what some states will be doing is, for example, the more progressive states will be offering women from other states, if they need to travel, that they will facilitate that. And that's a really important thing, because this is very much going to turn out to be a sort of a class impacting issue, if you like. If you have your own means, you can travel anyway. But if you don't, you would need that assistance. So this is a really important issue, and it will become, you know, more so in the coming months.
I wonder what laws conservative states are considering. I mean, for instance, could they make it illegal to travel to have the procedure?
Yeah, there is that. I've just been scrolling through the list of, what each state is planning to do or what each state has on the books already. And depending on where you live, I mean, if you live somewhere like Oklahoma maybe or Mississippi or whatever, and you are from a lower socioeconomic background and you become pregnant and that is not, what you want to happen, it's going to be extremely difficult. There's no doubt about it. So that's why it's such an emotional issue, because, those with means will always be fine, but those that don't, it just changes the course of their lives and sort of means that they're not in charge of their own destiny, which is quite a profound issue, really.
And in some of those conservative states, will some types of birth control also be criminalised?
Yes, that is another. It's interesting to see when something like this happens, or when you have a vote. It might be in the Supreme Court, or it might be within Congress, or whatever. And that there's a kind of conservative lurch. For example, what happens is a lot of women will sort of stockpile birth control because they don't quite know what's going to happen next. It's a kind of a knee-jerk reaction, and yet it's quite an understandable one. So there are some states where it would possibly become more difficult. Now, obviously, the internet is there and, that's a way around things. But just the kind of the culture and the idea that the state would involve itself so significantly and so proactively in people's lives is quite shocking, I think, and not least because the Republicans are the party of, more sort of a laissez-faire way of doing things, but not in this regard.
How much of a political risk was this Senate vote, given that a recent poll shows that I think it's 61% of Americans believe that abortion should be legal in all or at least most cases?
Well, yes. I mean, the tipping point has come a while ago now, whereby, as you say, it's gone past 50% in terms of the public. And if you look at the polls, it is broken down into sort of subcategories of, abortion being legal in all cases or abortion being legal in most cases. But even still, that takes you well over the 50% majority. So what this is doing now, it seems like just... it's a very unfortunate and I would say even unnecessary fight to be having at a time when the country could be coming together over a lot of other things, starting with the cost of living crisis, for example, which could have been some kind of a political unifier because, everybody has to eat. But now this, thanks to the Supreme Court developments last week, this has now been thrown out there. It's the cat on the table and everybody's talking about it. And it's just going to take up so much political bandwidth. I think it's a very unfortunate development, and it's not going to do the country or its politics any favours.
But might it be, in the end, be good for Democrats? And I mean, I wonder if it is actually going to play a role in getting voters out there as a vote motivator. Youngsters, younger people will want to vote for the Democrats to stop this happening. Will it affect the next election?
It could well do. I think the answer to that is it depends to some extent on how the economy is next autumn, because the cost of living crisis, the capacity to put food on the table and the capacity to heat your home, they tend to trump everything else for very obvious reasons. But those kind of post-material issues like abortion rights or in previous times like gay marriage or whatever, they are the things that get the youth vote out. And normally the youth, generally speaking, aren't so bothered about the midterms because they are deemed a bit boring. But this time around, they could be very, very motivated. So it could go either way. But certainly, if this is still a conversation in the autumn, as it well might, younger voters who are invariably going to vote Democrat will get out on election day. And that could be extremely significant.
And finally, Clodagh, could Joe Biden just end this by bringing in an executive order? And how would that work?
That would not be an appropriate route to go. I think this is a far, far, far too contentious issue. It's already been left to 9 individuals, in a country of well over 300 million. I think what would be a far more prudent route is to sort of consider some form of participatory democracy where citizens are actually, bought in and consulted rather than this top-down approach, which tends to get a lot of people's backs up. So I would say no to that, definitely.
Clodagh, thank you very much indeed. That's Clodagh Harrington there. Now, here's what else we're keeping an eye on today. The European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen has called Russia's invasion of Ukraine the most direct threat to world order. Von der Leyen made her comments following talks with the Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida in Tokyo. Officials in North Korea have ordered a strict national lockdown after confirming the country's first official COVID cases. State-controlled media said there's been an outbreak of the Omicron variant in the capital, Pyongyang, but didn't elaborate. One of the Catholic Church's most senior figures has been arrested in Hong Kong for breaking China's national security law. Cardinal Joseph Zen, who's 90, is one of four people who've been detained on charges of collaborating with foreign forces. And today's Monocle Minute reports that the University of Birmingham in the UK and the University of Technology in Jamaica are attempting to revive the Caribbean islands' railways. You can find out more at monocle.com/minute. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. Lots more to come here on The Globalist. Well, of course, we'll be looking through the papers from Zurich. We'll also be getting the very latest in business, and that's from Helen Morrissey coming up a little bit later. And of course, we've got fabulous Eurovision too. Shireen Abu Akleh, a veteran Palestinian-American correspondent for Al Jazeera, has been killed while covering a raid by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank. Well, let's get the latest now with Tahani Mustafa, who's Palestine analyst at the International Crisis Group, where she works on issues including security, socio-political issues and legal governance. Tahani, many thanks for joining us. Who was Shireen Abu Akleh and what was her place within the Palestinian media landscape?
Thank you for having me. So I just want to take a moment to just firstly express the feeling of grief that everyone here in the region is experiencing right now. Shireen was more than just a Palestinian icon. She was really, you know, a trailblazer for Arab women, especially really breaking the stereotypes, really breaking and shattering the glass ceiling that a lot of Arab women face socially and culturally across the region. So that grief is really being felt all over. I'm in Jordan at the moment, and obviously the feeling here is absolutely somber. You know, so many of us across the region grew up watching Shireen, you know, and the kind of trailblazing that organizations, news organizations like Al Jazeera and its correspondents like Shireen really provided in for a lot of countries, especially that can be classified as sort of news deserts, if you like, which makes a lot of the kind of outpouring of solidarity and condolences from even Arab regimes and their leadership really hollow at the moment. So, you know, absolutely, she was a Palestinian icon, but she was, you know, much more than that. You know, her reach, it's a real testament to her reach across the region.
What do we know about how she died?
I mean, Al Jazeera have come out and so have many witnesses, and they're calling this, you know, an extrajudicial killing. You know, this is an actual assassination of one of their most prominent correspondents. And unfortunately, this is not an isolated incident by any means. And what makes this really tragic is that it could have been avoidable had Israel, been brought to justice, had Israel's military establishment been brought to justice for the way that it not only harasses Al Jazeera's correspondents, but generally speaking, Palestinian journalists face this sort of systematic abuse daily. It's a daily occurrence for a lot of them. Shireen's murder unfortunately came only days after, you had the International Press Federation, Journalist Federation, and the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate bring a case to the ICC about the kind of harassment, precisely the sort of harassment that Palestinian journalists face in the field. And not only that, the murder of four other Palestinian journalists in the years preceding this, since 2015. We saw just in Gaza alone, during the Great Return March, two journalists were killed. Just last year, during the confrontations, Israel deliberately targeted the building that hosted the Associated Press and Al Jazeera. So this is not an isolated incident, which makes it really, really tragic, because if Israel had been brought to justice for the kind of killing with impunity that it so often gets away with, these instances wouldn't occur on the level that they do.
And so are you in agreement then with the Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas, who said that it was part of the occupation's policy of targeting journalists to obscure the truth and commit crimes silently? Do you think that that's a government policy, or is this just individuals acting?
I mean, it's very difficult to assume that this is just, like I said, an isolated incident or just, certain unintended rogue incidences. by any means, because it occurs on such a systematic level. You're talking about hundreds of Palestinian journalists that face this sort of harassment on almost a daily basis. You know, for a lot of us who do watch local media, you know, Palestinian media or even Arab news channels, when we do watch Palestinian correspondents in the field, we are left with jarring images, constant jarring images of their correspondents being tailed while they're on foot by Israeli military tanks. You see them being, you know, harassed in the field like we did during the protests in Sheikh Jarrah, you know, last year, where you had an Al Jazeera journalist being manhandled by Israeli police. You know, we constantly see them being fired at with stun grenades, rubber-coated bullets, live ammunition. So it's very difficult to assume that these are just, you know, one-off incidences or just, you know, a few soldiers disobeying commands by any means. This is a systematic Israeli policy of targeting specifically Palestinian journalists. You do not see these same images happen when it comes to correspondents from CNN, Fox News, the BBC, Sky News. I have never seen this in all the years where I've been working in the field actually happening to international journalists on the same level that it does to Palestinian correspondents.
However, there is obviously a call for an investigation, but Israel has also called for a joint probe into her death.
I mean, look, Israel has a notorious history for not only whitewashing its own crimes, but also never having ever brought a single soldier to justice when it has come to killing, to any killing of Palestinian journalists. There is not a single case where a single soldier has actually been brought to justice. And like I said, this is not an isolated incident. Shireen isn't the first journalist to be killed by the Israeli military. You know, just in the last 2 years alone, we've had six other journalists, Palestinian journalists, killed while they were reporting from the field. And in none of those cases was a single soldier brought to accountability. The Israeli military has a notorious reputation for the lack of accountability within its justice system. And so right now what is truly needed is an independent international investigation into this. We cannot rely on Israel to investigate its own crimes. And, you know, this is not just something that, you know, Palestinians are pulling from thin air or, you know, are speaking from a subjective place. This is objectively being called upon from, you know, numerous organizations, whether it's Israel's own human rights organizations, who they themselves admit that Israel cannot be relied upon to investigate this fairly, or from past experiences where, like I said, not a single Israeli soldier has ever been brought to justice, not only for the killing of Palestinian journalists, but also generally Palestinians. Thousands of Palestinians have been killed in the last decade, and not a single soldier has been truly brought to justice for that.
Tahani, thank you very much indeed. That's Tahani Mustafa of the International Crisis Group. You're listening to The Globalist on Monocle 24. It's 7:37 here in London, 8:37 in Zurich, and we'll continue now with today's newspapers. And joining me from our studio at Dürferstrasse 90 is Emilie Asserho, who is the programme coordinator for peace mediation at ETH Zurich. Good morning to you, Emilie.
Good morning, Georgina, from a rather beautiful and sunny Zurich.
Oh, you lucky thing. It's absolutely miserable here in London. Now, we are going to talk about the Åland Islands. I'm not even sure where that is.
That's right. So a bit of a continuation of the earlier discussion you had on NATO and Finland and Sweden potentially joining NATO. So the Åland Islands, which is a group of islands between Finland and Sweden, and since 1921 have been an autonomous region of Finland. So the League of Nations granted Finland sovereignty over the Åland Islands in 1921. And during these recent discussions on NATO, there's been a lot of discussion within Finland in terms of the status of the Åland Islands. So they have been granted a neutral and demilitarized status since 1921, and actually this dates back to the mid-1800s. So the discussion has been over the past few months if this status should change. It's very unlikely to change, but today the Helsingin Sanomat, the main newspaper from Finland, or the largest one, reports of a new initiative by the local social democracy Democrats on the Orlan Islands, essentially to create a new non-military service for the region. So when sovereignty over the islands were granted to Finland in 1921, the people populating these islands were essentially waived from the obligation to complete the national Finnish conscription or military or non-military social service. And instead, they would be allowed to serve in lighthouses or as pilots or in other bureaucratic services on the islands, but actually no system was ever created to this end. So now the Social Democrats on the Åland Islands are proposing that due to the autonomous, demilitarized and linguistic nature of the archipelago, it's a Swedish-speaking region of Finland, a completely new form of social service should be created that focuses on preparation for diverse crises, be it on healthcare, nursing skills, first aid, preparation for oil disasters or power cuts or evacuation of boats and ships in the case of disasters. So it's a new interesting initiative, again, in the context of the broader discussions on NATO in Finland and Sweden.
Let's pick up on another story we've been talking about today, and that is the US Senate and, of course, the failure to pass the law to guarantee abortion rights at the federal level. So how is the New York Times covering this?
So the New York Times is covering, as was discussed, the new piece of legislation that would have guaranteed abortion rights nationwide by essentially enshrining the landmark Roe versus Wade precedent in federal law. New York Times does point out that the law would have actually gone slightly beyond the simple codification of the Roe versus Wade by explicitly prohibiting a long list of abortion restrictions. The article focuses on the votes and the implications. So in short, it was a rather tight vote. 51 senators voted against the law, with 49 in favor, which fell short of the 60 votes that they would have needed to take this legislation, make it formal. And the vote did take place along party lines, so all Republicans voted against, and all Democrats, with the exception of Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, in favor. Now, there were two Republicans who say they would have voted in favor of simply codifying Roe versus Wade, Senator Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. Again, they would have favored a narrower bill that they say would have codified only Roe and not gone beyond that. Mm. Now, in the New York Times article, they focus on the implications and make the point the midterm elections are coming up in November, and this is a rallying point for the Democrats. They're hoping, and Vice President Kamala Harris made the same point, that now it's time to vote for those pro-choice candidates among the Democratic Party. So again, they're really trying to use this in the run-up to the midterm elections. Mm.
And we've also been covering the situation in North Korea, where they're finally admitting that they actually do have COVID.
That's right. So various outlets, NZZ in Switzerland, but also The Guardian, have reported that North Korea has indeed reported its first outbreak of the coronavirus officially, with leader Kim Jong-un declaring a severe national emergency and ordering all cities and countries or counties in the nation to really quickly eliminate the virus. And this came out after a test had been performed on Sunday by North Korean officials. And it's unclear how many people have been affected, but it is clear, or there's reports, that it is indeed the Omicron variant of the virus. And until now, as you mentioned, the country has really insisted that it had no cases of the virus since it emerged more than 2 years ago. But now severe measures are expected to take place. So Kim Jong-un called a meeting of the Politburo of the Workers' Party, and they're talking about tighter border controls, tighter lockdown measures, isolating all business and production activities in the country so people work at different times. So again, we'll need to see how this unfolds. The concern is, of course, that the population by and large is unvaccinated in North Korea, and the healthcare system is poorly resourced, so the implications on the humanitarian side would be devastating. Mm.
And I can't let you go, Emily, without you telling us about the new effective weight loss medicine.
Indeed. So Helsingin Sanoma reports on a new medicine. So just in terms of background, the World Health Organization has noted that obesity has nearly tripled since 1975. So really a great concern from a health perspective. And a new weight loss medicine by the name of tirzepatide, I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that, but it's a hormone treatment, has shown promising results in its third phase of testing. So during a period of 72 weeks, the participants in this study lost around 24 kilos on average, or 22.5% of their body weight. So this result is almost as good as surgeries done on weight loss, which often lead to a weight loss of 25 to 30 kilograms. So the results are very promising. Further studies are expected in 2023, and the hope is that this should create an alternative to existing weight loss medicines, hopefully in the end also bringing down some of those costs.
Sign me up. Emily, thank you very much indeed. That was Emily Eisenacher speaking to us from Zurich. You're listening to The Globalist on Monocle 24.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
It's time to talk business now with Helen Morrissey, who's Senior Pensions and Retirement Analyst at Hargreaves Lansdown. Helen, let's start with this UN report about carbon targets. What's the detail on this?
Yeah, so this is a really interesting one. So according to this report, we're now kind of hitting a critical mass of polluters setting carbon targets. So they're saying that around a quarter of firms in the most polluting sectors have now kind of joined the initiative to cut carbon targets, you know, over the coming years. And they believe that this could prove something of a tipping point, because obviously these really, really big companies influence actions across the whole supply chain. So this all sounds very, very positive. But then there's a separate report out there that kind of casts doubt on whether oil companies can actually deliver the carbon cuts that they're promising. And what they're saying is that, you know, some of these big oil firms, they're relying on unproven technologies. So for instance, you know, a lot of companies will talk about carbon offsetting, you know, where they'll plant trees, or carbon capture and storage. And what the report is saying is we don't quite know yet how technically feasible or cost effective these approaches are going to be. And they're kind of saying that, you know, investors need to look behind the claims to ask whether, you know, companies' targets are not just ambitious, but whether they're also credible.
Mm. And of course, as companies try and reduce their carbon footprint, what's happening is that all feeds into our cost of living crisis here. And there's a story you want to look at here about consumer confidence going into freefall because of this.
Yeah, I mean, this is a disturbing report. I mean, this is a UK-based one, but I think this is a pattern that is being repeated, you know, worldwide, really. So this report shows that, you know, concern about the cost of living is hitting record highs. And, you know, there's good reasons for this. You know, we've got concerns about lower growth. There was data out this morning showing the economy in the UK contracted by 0.1% in March, following no growth in February. So there's concerns here about a slowing economy, as well as warnings of double-digit inflation and possible recession as well. So all of this is really kind of harming consumer confidence in their finances, you know, going forward, which is a real, real concern.
And what about other metrics like house values, job security, business and so on? Is that stable? Mm-hmm.
And they have, so they have remained stable. So, you know, in the UK, you know, the house market has been surprisingly buoyant up until now. So I think that would be one reason why, you know, people would be feeling a bit more optimistic about that. You know, job security as well, you know, after furlough, we've seen more and more people returning to the workforce after the pandemic lockdowns. So, you know, people are feeling a bit more buoyant about that right now, because we've come off the back of, you know, difficulties with the pandemic, but we'll have to see how long that continues for. Mm.
And finally, a quick look at the Disney streaming service. How's that doing?
Yeah, so this looks, you know, like they're making big claims anyway in their latest results. So, you know, I think I've spoken on this programme before about, you know, obviously Netflix's woes, losing subscribers, etc. Whereas Disney's have shown, you know, that they want to sign up more subscribers. Subscribers are up in the most recent quarter. They've got plans for international expansion. This all sounds very, very positive, but what a lot of the analysts are saying is that, you know, is this growth that they're predicting actually going to bring bumper profits? So, you know, for instance, they're saying that they've paid a lot of money, higher programming expenses, for instance, you know, sports rights, you know, obviously they're in a real battle with the likes of Netflix for subscribers, so that's going to really push up the cost of their content. They also said that a lot of the new subscribers have come from India, and I think it said something like on, you know, on average their subscribers might pay an average of 76 cents a month. Now if you compare that to the US, subscribers are paying over $6 a month on average. So, you know, there's an issue there with the profitability. We might be seeing a lot more subscribers, but whether this feeds through to bigger profits for Disney Plus in the future very much remains to be seen.
And I think it's wonderful, though, that part of that content cost is the fact that they are actually producing roughly 500 shows in local languages, which can only be a positive development.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, it's great to see that they are very much, you know, looking to develop that, you know, rather than, you know, kind of the big, maybe, you know, US-based series, etc. So, yeah,
absolutely. Helen, thank you very much indeed. That was the Senior Pensions and Retirement Analyst, Helen Morrissey. And this is The Globalist on Monocle 24. And finally, on today's programme, the second Eurovision semi-final kicks off today, which Monocle's Eurovision correspondent Fernando Augusto Pacheco will, of course, be attending. Among the many entrants competing is Sweden's Cornelia Jacobs. Her emotional ballad Hold Me Closer is one of the favourites tipped to win. Well, earlier, Fernando sat down with Cornelia to discuss her Eurovision journey. He began by asking about her musical beginnings.
Well, maybe you're right, I'll find someone else. You say it isn't me, but when did that ever help?
I was in high school and my friend was in this girl band, and then one girl got fired and they were like, oh, we need another one. And my friend was like, I got one. And I was like, ooh, fun. Let's try it out. So I did that for a couple of years. But then after that, I had a DJ duo called Stockholm Syndrome, where we were DJing and singing everything on top, like all the vocals on live. So we made like a live show thing about the DJing, and that was fun for a couple of years. And then she moved out. She moved abroad. So she left the country, Sweden, where I'm from. So then I started to think about what I wanted to do myself, for me. And I kind of got back to my roots, where I always played in bands, and were more of a, like, I wanted to have a rock band. And I started to write music for myself instead, and like the kind of music that I wanted to sing and that I wanted to listen to. And that started, I think I started to write for that like 6 years ago, maybe. And I released my first single as a solo artist, 2018, Late Night Stories, as they call. And since then I have released
11 singles, like independently, or these last two singles was like Hold Me Closer and Fine that I released now just during Melodifestivalen in Sweden, which is the competition we have in Sweden to get to Eurovision, which I obviously won since I'm now here. So,
and it's a must watch, I have to say, for all Eurovision fans. I think Sweden is always the country that people look forward to about Eurovision. Isn't that right, Cornelia? I think Sweden has such a love relationship with Eurovision.
Exactly. We have always had that strong culture around the Melodifestivalen. Yeah, I mean, around Eurovision, but that's Melodifestivalen is the smaller version of Eurovision in Sweden. So we have had that for very, very many years. Music is very big in Sweden. The music industry is very, we're very like, yeah, out there in many ways. And we love this competition. I know that Swedes were like influencing Eurovision a lot towards like what it was going to be and how the competition works out. Because like, Christer Björkman, that was the chef for the boss for Sweden for many years. He has also been like producing Eurovision many, many years. So we have influenced Eurovision a lot. We like Eurovision in Sweden.
and I loved Sweden because of that as well. You know, I've been to Malmö and Stockholm when you recently hosted. And who knows, perhaps you're going to do it again. You're one of the favorites.
Who knows?
Tell us a bit more about Hold Me Closer, because it feels to me like quite an emotional song as well, right? I mean, tell us about it. It feels a little bit like a breakup song, but what do you feel about this track?
Definitely a breakup song. I was in the middle of a breakup or a couple of breakups during a period of time with the same person though. But, you know, it was this kind of on and off relationship. Yeah, he had a lot of problems with his mental health. So it was like, it didn't really work out because of that. So, which is quite hard when you have to like say goodbye to someone because of something else. It's not that you don't love each other or don't want to be with each other, but it just doesn't work out because someone is not like able to figure it out. So it's that kind of breakup song when you just have to leave. You have to accept and you have to accept the fact that you are not supposed to be with each other right now. And we wrote this song during the time this was happening. So we took all these like feelings and thoughts and even some of the lines that have been said in conversations are put into this song
which is quite interesting, because you know I keep telling my friends, because some people have this image of what an Eurovision song is. They think everything needs to be feathers and dance, but it's actually not really. There are a lot of ballads that do incredibly well, and even the staging, for example, your staging super elegant, you know, and which matches the song, right?
A lot has happened, I think, last years in Eurovision. It's been wider and broader in like genre-wise, and the people have been more and more pushing the limits, I think, for what we think that Eurovision is. Because I think that Eurovision can be anything. Eurovision can be whatever you'd like it to be. As long as, I mean, the only thing is, however, I mean, people like so much different stuff. I think we forget that sometimes. So we think that the people that watch Eurovision, they want a classic Eurovision song, but that's not the case. People like to listen to authentic music, I think, and whatever that is. I think that's the most important thing, to be like true to what you want to do and do stuff that feels authentic. People like that.
I think that's a great answer. And finally, Cornelia, besides saying good luck for the big final, I was going to ask, do you have any other favorite artists from this year's Eurovision, besides your beautiful song, of course?
Oh, thank you. Yes, I have. I really like Monika Liu from Lithuania and Estin from Holland. And also, I really like Chanel's performance. I think she's so cool. Sam Ryder is really good. Sheldon is really good. I think there's a lot of good songs this year.
Can't you see that you found the right one at the wrong time? It was just the wrong
Cornelia Jacobs there, speaking to Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and that second semi-final is screened tonight. That's all for today's programme. Thanks to our producers Rhys James, Emma Searle, Charlie Filmer-Court and Sophie Monaghan-Coombs. Our researcher Lillian Fawcett and Samson Mbogo, and our studio manager Chris Ablakwa. After the headlines, more music on the way. The Briefing is live at midday in London, and a little bit later today, Monocle Reads. We look at sound, the first sounds in the atmosphere. I'm Georgina Godwin. I'll be back on The Globalist at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.
هنا مونوكل 24 مونوكل 24 this.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
Broadcasting from London, Zurich, Hong Kong, Tokyo, Toronto and Los Angeles, you're listening to Monocle 24. With our daily digital bulletins, films, books, newspapers, magazines and radio service, we're your complete media partner around the world, around the clock. Stay with us. More great programming up next. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
It's 1600 in Seoul, 9 a.m. in Madrid, 8 a.m. here in London and 3 a.m. in New York. You're listening to Monocle 24. Hello from Midori House in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. Now, we've just had The Globalist, and if you missed today's edition, you can listen back online or wherever you get your podcasts. Coming up in a moment, Monocle's editorial director Tyler Brulé is in conversation with the chairman of Siemens, that's Jim Hagemann-Schnabe. That's ahead on The Chiefs. And we have more news and analysis on the horizon. The Briefing will be live from Studio One here at Midori House at midday London time. Tom Edwards will be your host for that. And we'll be discussing why inflation is expected to fall on the bulletin with UBS, and of course we'll enjoy some great music too. First though, here are the headlines. The European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen has called Russia's invasion of Ukraine the most direct threat to world order. Von der Leyen made her comments following talks with the Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida in Tokyo. Officials in North Korea have ordered a strict national lockdown after confirming the country's first official COVID cases. State-controlled media said there's been an outbreak of the Omicron variant in the capital, Pyongyang, but didn't elaborate. One of the Catholic Church's most senior figures